ages I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 645 of Unwelcome Guests, Potemkin Justice. I'm Robin Upton. If you don't know what a Potemkin village is, you might wish to check out Unwelcome Guests, episode 181, Potemkin Nation, the Illusion of U.S. Post-Peak Oil Prosperity. This week we're looking at the illusion of protection for whistleblowers and protection against the totalitarian surveillance control grid. It's a stark contrast, I know, from last week's show. The quiet reflections of Henry David Thoreau's life of self-sufficiency around Walden Pond, and perhaps the contrast between these episodes demonstrates just as clearly as John Taylor Gatto's expositions on the smaller details of how it was achieved, the success of the agenda of dumbing down, how the US was turned from a nation of staunchly independent, self-sufficient farmers to passive consumers of whatever the state and corporate machines turned out. Our first piece is a short interview with whistleblower Peter Van Buren. This is from February 26, 2012.
The halls of the State Department are haunted, not by actual ghosts, but by people who might as well be ghosts. They're called hallwalkers, people who blew the whistle, people who angered someone powerful, people who, for one reason or another, can't be fired. But they can be stripped of their security clearances, their desks, and their duties, and left to walk aimlessly up and down the halls of that massive building. Sometimes they're required to show up at the building to get paid. Sometimes they're allowed to telecommute from home. And after 23 years in the Foreign Service, Peter Van Buren joined their ranks last fall when he published a scathing account of his year working on what he believed were wasteful reconstruction projects in Iraq, like a multi-million dollar chicken processing plant that never really got off the ground.
The problem came when General Odierno's blogger friend decided she wanted to see the chicken plant. I don't know how she heard about it. Maybe she saw it on a list. And we were stuck with having chickens in the plant the day she arrived. The word got around very quickly that the Americans were buying chickens for cash, and the price went up probably 100% that afternoon. We got 50 or 60 chickens. We ran them through the plant when she was there.
Wait, you did this, almost staged this for Odierno's, somebody who was writing a blog for General Odierno.
We came to call it the Potemkin Chicken Plant, remembering back to the early days in Russia where the money was squandered, and so they built a stage set to impress the empress. With future visitors, we evolved a sliding scale of chickens, depending on the relative importance. If you were a big shot reporter from a television network, you'd see 50 or 60 chickens slaughtered for your pleasure. If you were a print journalist from a known newspaper, 10 or 20. With respect from NPR, maybe 4 or 5 chickens.
Peter, with all due respect, I mean, sorry, just to get serious for a moment, I mean, that's fraud. Why were you doing that? That wasn't part of your mandate. You were the head of a provincial reconstruction team. Why didn't you just be honest and say, when people came, say, listen, this is a project that just doesn't seem to be working?
Honesty was one of the few things we had in short supply in Iraq. From Washington through the embassy, including the army, there was an incessant demand for success. We were under extraordinary pressure to show that the State Department was succeeding in reconstruction in Iraq where other organizations had failed previously.
Why did you decide to write about it later on?
By the time I was finished, the overwhelming sense that I had participated in this caught me and made me realize that the story that people were hearing back home was not the story of what we were doing there on the ground. And I realized that this was a story that probably needed to be told, particularly as I watched the program in Iraq be folded up, packed up, and shipped off to Afghanistan, where, in fact, the same process is going on right now. We needed to learn from that lesson, and so I wrote this book.
Did you have authorization to write the book?
Absolutely. The State Department requires all of us to submit our writing in advance, a 30-day suspension period, while they review it.
Since then, since its publication last fall, You say the State Department has retaliated against you. They have taken away, for example, your security clearance. What else has happened since?
The State Department, when I came back from Iraq, gave me a position that was consummate with my experience. I was assigned to the Board of Examiners to help choose the next generation of Foreign Service officers. Unfortunately, through a trumped-up charge that a link on my blog was considered a security violation, I lost my security clearance. That caused the State Department to then proclaim that my judgment in my job selecting new Foreign Service officers was in question, and I was kicked out of that job when a particularly offensive blog post caught their attention in late October, Hillary Clinton chortling over the death of Muammar Gaddafi. I was told that I was no longer wanted, and I was sent home. I was told in writing that I was banned from any State Department facility. I could not access the computer network. I had no job tasks in front of me. They couldn't figure out a way to stop paying me. And so I sat home for 8 weeks at full salary doing nothing.
Well, here's a question. I mean, if you, let's say, violated the State Department's policies or you did something they didn't like or they felt that you had exercised a poor judgment, as they claimed, why couldn't they fire you?
There are procedures in the State Department to fire someone or to discipline someone. There are rules that the State Department claims I've broken. But rather than pursue those avenues, which would have allowed me to defend myself, the State Department instead followed a different path where they used bureaucratic tools, unofficial ways of doing business that pushed me out of the village, sent me into the wilderness.
Wait, so let me just get this straight, Peter. You are an active member of, you are an active employee of the State Department.
That's correct.
Right now. But you don't go there every day.
I am not allowed to go there every day. I fought a 8-week battle with the State Department to get my entry badge back. I'm currently assigned as a teleworker, largely without portfolio.
And you are paid the salary of somebody who's been there for 20
years. The same salary that I've earned for my years of experience. That's correct.
Was it worth it? Was it worth, all you've been through and now you're about to end your career?
It's a very difficult question to answer and one that, to be honest, I've thought about quite a bit. However, when I go home and turn on the news and listen to the Secretary of State claiming that the rights of bloggers in China need to be respected, that journalists in Syria have a right to speak back to their government, that people in Vietnam who use Twitter and freedom fighters around the world who want to organize through Facebook all have rights to these things, that the internet is a force for good and freedom, and at the same time, the same Secretary of State's organization is seeking to oust me, to destroy me, to push me out of it. I realize that that level of hypocrisy needs to be answered, and I find that, yes, it is worth it. It was worth it, and it will be worth it to answer that level of hypocrisy and demand from that Secretary of State, Madam, why is your institution not allowing me the same rights that you're bleating about for bloggers around the world? Why not here at home?
Peter Van Buren, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Peter Van Buren is the author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. His case has been taken up by the Office of Special Counsel, an independent federal agency set up to help whistleblowers. While the State Department declined to comment on his specific situation, spokesman Mark Toner gave us this statement, quote, "The State Department values the opinions of its employees and encourages expression of differing viewpoints and is committed to fairness in the workplace."
Sounds to me like Peter Van Buren is holder of a personal philosophy, a man with values and personal commitment to them, intent on doing things which satisfy him rather than the organization which employs him. Not a safe pair of hands, therefore. He can't be counted on to do what he's told to do and desist when he's told to desist. He might, for example, call black black and white white, whether or not this suits the purposes of his employers. And the fairness that State Department claims to be committed to doesn't perhaps include allowing him to continue purposeful employment. Perhaps there is no purposeful employment for a man with such values. It seems that he's entitled to a certain Potemkin justice, some nice-sounding words, a paper-thin facade of proper treatment, behind which expediency is the order of the day. How many whistleblowers have actually been, in practice, protected, I wonder, by this Protection Act? What sort of protection are they afforded? Are people so dumbed down that the passing of a piece of legislation called the Whistleblower Protection Act is sufficient to put people's mind at rest? Whether or not it's ever actually used, whether or not it actually, in practice, protects whistleblowers. As we shall hear from the next interview, the track record for those who blow the whistle on the US government is not good at all and is getting increasingly worse at a rate of knots. Thank you to Sibel Edmonds and Peter B. Collins for this production from The Boiling Frogs. This interview is from the 4th of February 2013, and it starts with Peter B. Collins asking Jocelyn Raddick whether she ever aimed to become a whistleblower.
Would it be correct to assume that you never sought to earn that label?
That's correct. I don't think many people wake up in the morning and say, wow, today I'm going to be a whistleblower. I think people like me and Sibel, we were just doing our jobs and came across circumstances that were quite disturbing and ended up through a series of steps complaining internally and then later going public.
And Jess, your case revolved around the issues of the detention and interrogation of John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban. You wrote about it in your book, Traitor, The Whistleblower and the American Taliban, in quotes. And as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I live in Marin County, California, where John Lind grew up. His father, Frank, lives about three blocks from where I'm sitting right now. So we followed that case with interest, and you were working under Attorney General Ashcroft in the Justice Department. Tell us briefly what the issues were that you got involved with that ultimately led to you being forced out of the Justice Department.
Sure. I was the ethics attorney who advised that the United States could not interrogate John Walker Lind without his attorney, and parenthetically, that it couldn't torture him. I didn't think this was radical advice at the time, but apparently it turned out to be. I later learned that there was a federal court order for all Justice Department correspondence related to Lind's interrogation. And I also learned that only two of my emails had been turned over. I had written about a dozen documenting that the FBI committed an ethics violation in its interrogation of Lind. And it was quite disturbing to find out not only was I not informed of a federal court order, but that those emails I'd written had mysteriously disappeared. So I did the logical thing, I thought, by resurrecting them from my computer and turning them over to my boss. My boss still did not turn them over to the prosecutor. I later tried to go to the judge after I resigned from the Justice Department because I didn't want to be a part of this. And I was told I had no standing. At that point, I released the emails to the media, which quickly led to the collapse of the John Walker Lind case.
And fortunately, from the government's point of view, or from the administration's point of view, because they didn't want this to become public, Lind pled guilty to two relatively minor charges, drew a 20-year sentence, and so these issues were never brought before a court.
That's correct. The morning that the suppression hearing was due to begin, that was going to decide whether the statements he made to the interrogators, the one that I had advised against, whether those would be admissible against him in court. But the case suddenly settled on the morning the suppression hearing was due to begin, surprising everybody, including the judge.
So you were, you know, you went to Yale Law School. You were recruited into the Justice Department. This must have been an episode that really shattered your faith in the system that you were working to support.
Absolutely. You have to remember, the Justice Department, at the time it was going after Lind, it was simultaneously prosecuting Enron and Arthur Andersen for obstruction of justice and destruction of evidence. So it was quite inconceivable to me that the same Department of Justice would be destroying evidence. And it really did open my eyes in terms of the retaliation that followed, about how vicious the government could be against people who are telling the truth and speaking truth to power.
Jess, through Sibel and her group, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, I've now talked with a whole range of whistleblowers from virtually every agency. And I wanted to ask you to kind of enumerate some of the patterns here. But maybe the easiest way to approach this is to say, have there been successful whistleblowers in the national security arena who reported wrongdoing via the systems that are set up and maintained their job and their security clearance?
Wow, it's hard to think of a single one. Occasionally, for example, in the case of Jane Turner, she won before the internal FBI system and they awarded her back pay. But then just the other day, they revoked that. But really, I don't know a single person that got their job back or their security clearance back by going through the proper channels or even other legal channels available to them in federal court.
Mm-hmm. And now that you support whistleblowers in your work at GAP, the Government of Accountability Project, you have seen the kinds of tactics that are used. And we'll get into the Kiriakou case in more detail in a moment. But many people are aware of what has occurred there. And in many cases, the loss of a security clearance, even before the individual has lost his or her job, is the critical factor that makes them unable to perform their duties, unable to make a living. And then the government has the ability to throw lawyers and resources at a case and maintain it for years to drain the financial ability of the whistleblower to defend their actions in court.
That's absolutely right. Pulling someone's security clearance is the kiss of death for anyone who works in the national security or intelligence arenas. It's often a job requirement. And so by pulling their security clearance, you render them unemployed and unemployable. This is a frequent tactic, increasingly so. Often they will suspend a security clearance without revoking it, which makes it impossible for you to challenge. But we're seeing this increasingly. And in my case, in John Kiriakou's case, I mean, that was the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the Bush administration, lefties like me were agitated and very concerned. And we saw individuals like you and Sibel Edmonds get incredible treatment. The retaliation that was applied, the expansive use of the state secrets privilege to try to classify information like Sibel's date of birth or public letters that had been written by Senators Grassley and Leahy that were classified in a retroactive manner. And in Sibel's case, she appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. She tried the congressional oversight route. She tried the media and 60 Minutes route. And in every avenue, she was shut down. And we thought that it could not possibly get worse. But under the Obama administration, We have seen no efforts to hold accountable wrongdoing that occurred in the prior administration. And in an alarming manner, we have seen more prosecutions of whistleblowers, including heavy-handed use of the Espionage Act, than under any president before in American history.
That's absolutely right. Sabell and I were contemporaneous whistleblowers, and we were both going through our own living hell. For me personally, I ended up being put under criminal investigation and referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed as an attorney and put on the no-fly list. But at least I was never indicted. It took the Obama administration to start indicting and prosecuting whistleblowers and doing so under the very heavy-handed, completely out of scope, vague, ambiguous Espionage Act, which is meant to go after spies, not whistleblowers.
Jess, you and I have been through a lot, and we spent a lot of time together in 2004, 2005, rallying in Congress, you know, collecting petitions, holding press conferences in front of various congressional offices. And I stopped doing that. That is me and the organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, because they all proved to be futile. I mean, you were with us. You were doing the same thing. So we did try that so-called channel, and it had zero effect. And the same thing even with the, you know, with the courts and with the media. And now after 11 years, when I pause and when I think of the most important factor or cause for this entire situation, my conclusion is that it's mainly because of the apathy, and that is public apathy. And this is the large majority. Because the reason we were not getting anywhere and we couldn't get anywhere and we are still not getting anywhere, whether with the Congress or the courts and with both administration, one being worse than the other, is we never could gather public support. And do you agree with this assessment?
I do agree that there's a huge problem with the public apathy factor, but I think at least recently, that's been exacerbated by the government very public crackdown and silencing of people who are trying to dissent. And so by labeling people traitors and enemies of the state, which you do by charging someone under the Espionage Act, it's the most serious crime and that can be leveled against an American. I do blame the government for creating an incredibly hostile environment for even those people who are not apathetic to speak out in, because suddenly they're afraid that they're going to be caught up under this umbrella of being somehow traitorous to the country by associating with or helping the causes of current whistleblowers. You know, for all the amazing hard work you did, that we did, I feel like we didn't change the whistleblower world, but we nudged it in the right direction.
Well, that you are reflecting the positive side, and it's good to hear it. Actually, it's refreshing. I guess maybe I am a bit too jaded or too realistic. I can't decide which one it is. But let's take the media here. I mean, we had this tragic incident, the Sandy Hook incident, and it played and it led to people mobilize on both sides. So think about that and say, with all these prosecutions and persecutions, the witch hunt, these incredible whistleblower cases, if the media would have, even currently, tribute 1% of the attention they give to the celebrities, to, you know, the tragic incidents, where would we be today as whistleblowers?
I agree. I think it would help tremendously. And I mean, I remember when I was trying to publish my book, and it was ridiculous that Paris Hilton's Chihuahua could publish a book, but I couldn't find a publisher at the time. In terms of publicity,
I
do feel like in the case of Thomas Drake, that case was won as much in the courtroom as in the court of public opinion. That's, we waged a huge media campaign on his behalf, and it was a 1-2-3 punch with him winning the Ridenour Award, followed by a blockbuster piece by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker, followed by a 60 Minutes piece. But again, that took all the stars aligning, and that took a huge years-long effort to kind of educate the public that this guy is a whistleblower and not a spy. That was one case, and the only one, where I felt like the media actually served as the government watchdog rather than its lapdog.
One last question and comment on this particular topic, and that is, had we done what we did, you and I, in 2002, 2003, under this president, Barack Obama, we would be right now facing jail time, or we'd be already sitting somewhere in the jail. Do you agree with this assessment?
I agree with that completely. I think we both would have been criminally investigated. I know there was a grand jury on me. I'm confident we would have been indicted and prosecuted under President Obama.
Jess, now let's take a look at the case of Thomas Drake. You were one of the attorneys on his case. And on this program, we discussed it with our friend who's the expert on the NSA, James Bamford. And I wanted to get your take because just recently a friend of mine who lives in Washington met Tom Drake, who is now working at an Apple store at the Genius Bar. And I find that really tragic. And I agree with you that you did a great job of generating publicity. I think a lot of people who didn't understand whistleblowing or the extent to which Obama and his colleagues have been cracking down got a sense of that. But tragically, this man who tried to protect our constitutional rights and tried to save taxpayers tens of millions of dollars on the intercept software that was being employed at the National Security Agency. He did have to plead guilty to, a single charge of misusing a government computer. But he can no longer work, and he's a highly skilled professional. And to see him making, and Apple, by the way, is giving raises finally, but $15 or $20 an hour, is something that I find as a real modern-day human tragedy.
Yes, it has a huge personal cost. And even though Tom's criminal case collapsed in spectacular fashion, you have someone who was a senior executive in the government making over $150,000 a year, now working as a wage-grade employee at an Apple store. Additionally, he had to dig into his pension, his retirement, in order to pay legal bills, and there are huge tax consequences to that. And he also had to get a second mortgage on his house. So yes, even if you, quote, win the case, you are still personally destroyed. Tom will never work in the intelligence community again, which I think is a huge loss for our country, because he's an amazing cryptographer and engineer. Yet we have relegated him to working in a profession that is way below his capabilities. I think he loves working at Apple because of the human interaction factor of it. But the whole purpose back then and now is to leave you blacklisted, bankrupted, and completely broken as a person.
And I would add to that to set an example for others who might try to do the right thing themselves.
And, absolutely.
And this leads to the incredible brushback of your client, John Kiriakou. And we had hoped that John would be able to join us today, But we understand that he has just a few days remaining before he has to report for his 30-month sentence. And we'll get to the bizarre elements of the sentencing hearing as we talk about this. But first, the biggest outrage here is that John Kiriakou didn't torture anyone. And he did talk to reporters and tell them unclassified information about the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah and other, again, non-classified, non-sensitive information. He was treated this way, retaliated against, in my view, because he told the truth and broke a kind of code of silence. And so ultimately, he pled guilty to a lesser charge, and we'll get into that in a moment. But please talk about the big picture here, that we had a torture program that is now the subject of a feature film that has produced some discussion, but in general locks in the myth that A, torture was okay, and B, that torture produces actionable intelligence. And to see those like Bruce Jessen, who was paid along with his colleagues to reverse engineer this torture program from the anti-torture training that was given to our troops, to see those who authorized it right up to the highest levels of government, including the president himself, to see them selling books and not having to spend time with their lawyers, while John Kiriakou becomes the single American who is going to spend time in jail for anything related to the barbaric and misguided torture program that was utilized just a few years ago.
Yes, it's what makes a tragic case absolutely repugnant. At the beginning of the first term of his administration, Barack Obama conferred blanket immunity on all CIA officers who were following Justice Department guidance, which we know at the time were twisted memos written by my law school contemporary, John Yoo. So the result is that the people who authorized torture, the people who ordered torture, the lawyers who justified it, the people who carried out torture, and the people who destroyed the videotapes, none of them have been prosecuted or ever will be. And the only CIA officer involved in the program, the torture program, is the one who blew the whistle. He's the only one going to jail. And meanwhile, as you point out, people like Jose Rodriguez, who headed the entire rendition, detention, and interrogation program, is enjoying his little book deal and happily promoting his book, which was approved by the government. And we have a blockbuster Hollywood film legitimizing the false narrative that torture worked. It's absolutely absurd. It adds insult to the injustice of John Kiriakou's conviction.
And Jess, as we're speaking here on February 1st, it was just a few days ago that Jose Rodriguez, John Rizzo, the former CIA counsel, and the former head of CIA and National Intelligence, Michael Hayden, got together for a little chit-chat at the American Enterprise Institute, where they offered rationalizations about the so-called enhanced interrogation program. And they are permitted to speak freely as they try to, I think rationalize is the best term, their misdeeds. And here, John is going to go to federal prison for 2.5 years.
That's right. It seems part of the ethos that Sabelle and I dealt with a decade ago of screw up, cover up, and get promoted. And everyone in this scenario who's behaved atrociously and engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity have all enjoyed wonderful careers and that just get better and better. And the most recent example is the fact that John Brennan, the drone daddy, who single-handedly decides who, as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, can kill anybody on the entire planet. He's about to become the CIA director.
I'm glad you added that. I was about to. And let me just get your thought on this briefly. It's likely that John Brennan will be confirmed. There are only a couple of rogue constitutionalists in the United States Senate, two from Oregon and one from Kentucky, two Democrats and one Republican, and I'll name them, Merkley and Wyden from Oregon and Senator Paul from Kentucky, who are really planning to ask tough questions of John Brennan at his confirmation hearing. But my thought about that is that Barack Obama is setting up the United States Senate in confirming John Brennan to return to the CIA as its director as essentially a sign-off on the drone program, the surveillance programs, and many other covert actions that are not all that secret, but that have been operating over the past 10 to 11 years.
I agree completely. It's a stamp of approval for all that's been the worst atrocities our country's been engaged in, including a kill list where any American can be vaporized with no due process whatsoever. In a way, I believe that the torture program, which was too messy because we ended up tainting the trials of anyone at Guantanamo we tried to bring to justice, they've dealt with that problem by deciding just to drone those people. And you eliminate all those yucky due process problems of trying to bring their cases to trial. And John Brennan is just going to completely legitimize all the worst of America. And I do hold Obama to account for that. He has presided over a huge expansion of secrecy from the Bush administration. And that's saying a lot, because under Bush, we had rampant overclassification. We had secret signing statements and a whole number of other things, including state secrets privilege being asserted. And Obama has bettered Bush. He's bested Bush on all of those counts.
And aiding and abetting him is the man who leads the department where you used to work, Eric Holder, Attorney General. And on the one hand, for him to agree to the mass grant of immunity, and there was a written grant of immunity to CIA officers related to the torture program, but the unofficial immunity is that there have been no investigations or prosecutions of clear wrongdoing. And he has fronted that. And then there's the flip side of it, where, for example, recently, in a rare exception, the Second Court of Appeals has twice thrown out convictions based on conspiracy and material support counts of individuals who were held at Guantanamo. And it's very clear that there was no language that included those as war crimes at the time that these men were tried and convicted. And yet, Holder insists that in the show trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged accomplices, that he is insisting that General Martins may not drop the conspiracy charges, even in view of the clear conflict with these recent court rulings.
That's right. General Martins was put in charge to try to resurrect military commissions and give them an aura of legitimacy before the eyes of the world. And Martins himself has been very public, to his credit, has been very public about the fact that these military commissions are a huge problem and are not working. And I think that's been borne out by what we've seen in the pretrial proceedings of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, the other day, as a defense was about to make its argument, suddenly the audio and visual feed to the courtroom was cut by some mysterious man behind the curtain who no one knew. Even the judge didn't know.
Right.
At first, the Justice Department said, well, we know, but we can't explain in public. And then the next day, apparently the original classification authority, the OCA, which I think is a euphemism for the CIA, was blamed. And Judge Pohl issued an order saying, no, you may not just arbitrarily censor what's going on and what is supposed to be a public trial. But it just shows, I mean, we're on the third or fourth iteration of military commissions now, that they don't work. And as you pointed out, even though there were those two cases in which Holder lost because the court said you can't charge people with crimes that did not exist at the time they were taken into custody. You know, we have that little pesky thing in the Constitution called the ex post facto clause. Despite Holder's objections, you know, he ordered Martins to continue with these very dubious prosecutions.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Now, Jesselyn Radack, I want to turn to the bizarre events in the sentencing hearing of John Kiriakou that occurred just over a week ago. And I first picked up in the news accounts in the New York Times the inappropriate and I would call snarky commentary that came from the judge, Leonie Brinkema. And she kind of editorialized saying that, and this was a pro forma hearing because there had been a plea deal, and really all she had to do was gavel down and approve it. But she had to add that I think that 30 months is way too light. And then she invited, as any defendant would be, Mr. Kiriakou to make a statement. And he declined. And she inserted a remark that I found ugly. Perhaps you have already spoken too much. Now, as if that is not offensive enough, you have revealed in a post at Daily Kos that there were other hijinks, is what I might call them, that occurred in this courtroom. Please explain.
Yes. Well, first of all, the comments that you already expressed by Judge Brinkema are completely inappropriate and actually a violation of judicial ethics canons. And I believe attorneys are in the process of filing an ethics complaint against her. Interestingly, back in October, when John pled guilty, she said that 30 months was an appropriate sentence for him. And everyone wonders what changed her mind between October and December. And what I'll tell you, what changed her mind was a secret, quote, victim impact statement by the supposedly covert officer, whose name everybody knows, against John. Now, neither the public nor the defendant, John Kiriakou, were allowed to see this obviously inflammatory and prejudicial statement, yet it formed a large part of the sentencing hearing about how John had harmed this person and harmed the CIA and harmed the country.
And Jess, let me just inject here that in the plea bargaining, what John ultimately accepted as the single charge that he pled guilty to was violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. Now, this had nothing to do with the information that he gave to reporters about the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah or related matters. This was the gotcha that when he went in for that FBI interview that Scott Shane detailed in the January 6th New York Times article, that that's what they were able to stick him with. So this then led to this secret victim statement that was presented to the judge, but the defendant, since he had lost his security clearance, wasn't permitted to see it. Were you or any of the attorneys permitted to see this victim impact statement?
I did not see it, and the night before the statement came out, they pulled John's security clearance specifically so he could not see it. The count that he pled guilty to didn't involve the Scott Shane article. It actually involved the fact that he confirmed the name to a journalist. He confirmed the name of a torturer. Mm-hmm. The journalist already had this name, and this name was widely known within the human rights community of activists and journalists. John merely confirmed the name. It was never made public. It went into a sealed court filing that was held by the Guantanamo defense attorneys. That was John's sin. He basically outed a torturer. You know, meanwhile, everybody knows who this guy is. His name is Thomas Donahue Fletcher, and he lives in Vienna, Virginia. And you can find his information on switchboard.com or through an Intellia search. Yet supposedly he was tremendously harmed, the evidence of which the only part that we could hear publicly was that it turned out some people in his family had not known that he was a CIA officer, which is actually quite common.
And in your post, you argue that that was amplified or exaggerated to become endangering his life.
Yes, exactly. He said that, apparently, he said that he felt like his life had been endangered by this, though I would argue this guy was hardly undercover. If me, I'm not an investigator, I don't have a security clearance, and I was able to figure out who he was. It's hard for me to hear, you know how his life was endangered, and no one else can know because no one's allowed to see the secret statement, even though it formed a lot of what went into the sentencing hearing, which, as you note, was supposed to be pro forma because the sentence had been agreed to back in October. Both sides agreed and the judge approved 30 months. So to have all of that theater, political theater, at the sentencing hearing was just appalling.
And Jess, you point out that there was discussion of the charges that had been dropped, which is, again, highly inappropriate.
Understand. Basically, yes, during the sentencing hearing, what had happened was when John pled guilty, the prosecution created a statement of facts that included a whole bunch of descriptions of the other charges. And John complained to the judge at the time, why are all these other charges being described, even though I'm only pleading guilty to one? And the judge kind of blew it off and said, don't worry, it's just window dressing. It doesn't mean anything. Well, it meant a hell of a lot because the government, both during the sentencing hearing and afterwards in its statements to the press by Neil McBride in particular, trotted out all of those other allegations that had been dropped about outing Deuce Martinez, who was never undercover, and about trying to trick the CIA into approving his book by describing a magic box. And I mean, a whole bunch of other absurd allegations that were going to be thrown out. A number of them were going to be thrown out. Yet they use them to inflame the picture, the caricature of John Kiriakou that the government wanted to paint.
Well, Jess, I see this as part of a bigger and very troubling pattern. And let me just cite a couple of other cases where I've seen what I refer to as judicial sleight of hand. The Al Haramain charity case was the single case where the victims were able to prove that they were illegally wiretapped. And on appeal, the full en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit, the allegedly uber-liberal court, basically inserted an opinion that they had pursued the wrong cause of action. That's something that is more appropriate to the trial court level, not the appeals court. In the appeal of Judge Forrest's ruling, which placed the permanent injunction on the detention clause of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, in the hearings where the government succeeded in lifting that injunction and reinstating this onerous law, they added testimony from the government saying that Chris Hedges and other plaintiffs had nothing to worry about. They would not be detained under this law. And the government had repeatedly refused to offer similar assurances throughout the trial proceedings, and it drew a strong rebuke from the judge in her powerful decision that was released on December 12th of 2012. And finally, in a case that I followed where the Montana law that banned corporate contributions, which was overturned based on the precedent of Citizens United, when that case arrived at the Supreme Court, it had a certain title. And the name of that title was ultimately changed, and it changed from the Attorney General of Montana to naming him as an individual. And attorneys who I spoke with said that this sidestepped possible invocation of the 11th Amendment. And so we see the courts kind of playing fast and loose with procedures and with the rights of the accused. And I want to know if you see a larger pattern as well.
Absolutely. And I think the government is also playing fast and loose with shutting these cases down or thwarting them. The Al-Haramain case, because that Muslim charity had standing because, whoops, the government accidentally sent them copies of their conversations that had been recorded by the government, their conversations with their own lawyers. So there was not a better case where people had standing to prove that they're being warrantlessly wiretapped, which usually most people can't prove because they don't know about it. Yet the government came in and asserted state secrets privilege. They've done that in a number of cases. My recollection is that was an issue in Sabell's case. And I know in the other cases, for example, with the NDAA case, in full disclosure, I am the subject of one of the amicus briefs, talks about my case and Tom Drake's case because we had been declared a traitor and a turncoat and a terrorist sympathizer in my case and an enemy of the state in Tom Drake's case, meaning that we had a valid fear of indefinite preventive detention under this law. That is going to be argued next Wednesday, and I will be in New York with Tom Drake and Dan Ellsberg and Chris Hedges and Alexa O'Brien, another plaintiff in the lawsuit. But again, yeah, I don't doubt at all that the government, that would be nice actually to have a little statement from the government saying, I don't have to worry about indefinite preventive detention. If only they could give that kind of assurance to every person in the United States, maybe that would hold some water, but they don't. It's an absolute executive power that's been completely expanded that allows the government to pick up anyone and put them away without charge, counsel, or judicial review, and without anyone even knowing, even their families knowing where they are. And you can be put into the equivalent of the black hole, otherwise known as Guantanamo Bay, under that provision.
Jess, for the last few years, I've been writing about, talking about, we have been having guests to talk about this whole issue of the separation of powers really no longer existing when you have all three branches colluding together. That is the executive branch and the judiciary and the legislative. For most people, it is pretty easy to understand when we talk about the Congress and say, okay, well, we know about the Congress. We know about the power of, the lobby and the campaign financing issues. So by the time a lot of these people get in there, they have already sold their souls and they are corrupt and they are basically scumbags, excuse my language. But it is harder for people to understand and analyze the courts, and specifically the federal courts, because while it's easy to see and understand and assess the main reasons and the entire collusion between the executive branch and the Congress, people don't understand how is it that it's so easy, so very easy for the executive branch to collude with the federal courts to sway them very, very easily. And for most of these judges, the majority of them to very easily going along with it, you know, for them to just go along with this whole scheme. How do you explain it to a lot of people who say, so yeah, we were supposed to have these separation of powers, and I know with all the stuff with NDAA and the Patriot Act, but what happened to that, you know, so-called or supposed more independent courts and that separation? And besides the classification, are there any other ways that the executive branch, you know, controls, sways, influences the federal courts? How do they do it?
I think very much. A number of federal courts, even though they supposedly have independence and the protection of lifetime tenure, they act often as a rubber stamp of what the government wants to do. And they give way too much deference to what the government says. They take it at face value rather than acting as a trier of fact. Now, there have been a number of judges pushed back and said, no, you need to show the proof. You need to show the evidence. You can't just make these bald assertions. But again, those judges have been overturned on appeal by other judges who are more pro-government. And the problem is we have an expanded executive branch that's become imperialistic. Basically, the checks and balances are so out of whack when you have a rubber stamp Congress. And then even when the judiciary does flex its muscle on rare occasions, then the executive plays the ultimate trump card with the state secrets privilege by completely shutting down the lawsuit.
Jess, one other area that I'd like to explore with you relates to the legal status of whistleblowers and recent legislation that was intending to strengthen the protections for whistleblowers and appears to have done nothing of the sort. First of all, there is a standalone bill. And secondly, there was an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act for 13, which is called the Non-Federal Employees Whistleblower Protection Act. And the president, in his signing statement, when he put the NDAA into law, took exception to the whistleblower protection for government contractors and subcontractors. So if you would, could you update us on the recent legislation and then evaluate the extent to which it actually does provide new protections, particularly in the national security sector?
Well, I think the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act does provide some improvements for whistleblowers at the FDA or at an agency, not national security. Like the original Whistleblower Protection Act, it completely exempts national security and intelligence employees, who I think are the ones you would most want to hear from about governmental wrongdoing. Then there was a presidential directive, which a lot of people say was further whistleblower protection, but really it created a right without a remedy, which is of no use whatsoever. And then the icing on the cake is the NDAA, the contractor provision in the NDAA and the presidential signing statement. Now, my colleague Tom Devine, and we differ on this, but my colleague thinks it won't really make a difference and it doesn't really matter. Signing statements aren't enforceable. And while that is technically correct, that they don't have the force of law, they certainly do have a tremendous influence on how subordinate agencies are going to interpret a law. So effectively, by issuing that signing statement, you cut out whistleblower protection for 12 million government contractors. So we have these, I feel like these kind of scraps or these crumbs that are being tossed to the whistleblower community. And we're supposed to be so grateful for example, that temporarily they're ending monopoly jurisdiction of the federal circuit court over whistleblower cases and things like that, that's a step in the right direction. But we're not protecting the people who need it the most.